Cha-ching. That's the sound of Lowe's Labor Day savings. Get up to 45% off select major appliances and save up to an additional $100 on select laundry pairs. Plus, get 3 bags of Miracle-Gro 0.75 cubic foot garden soil for just $10. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in-store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for more details. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, this is Kevin.
This is Joe.
And Nick Jonas from Hey Jonas. This episode of Hey Jonas is brought to you by the all-new drink lineup at McDonald's.
I don't have to tell you that there are already so many great drink options at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. But the new drink lineup, I mean, it takes things to another level.
They've got delicious caffeinated refreshers like the strawberry watermelon refresher, crafted sodas like the Sprite Berry Blast, and now the all-new Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer.
We're talking about a total game changer. It's made with Red Bull. It's mixed with blue raspberry flavor and topped with freeze-dried dragon fruit.
Wow.
McDonald's has given us a refreshing new boost for your day.
And the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer is arriving just as you're heading back to the dorms for the fall semester. It's got a boost of energy and a kick of flavor when you need it the most. You know, powering through those lectures and studying sessions, you're gonna need it. Kicking the afternoon slump or rallying for the weekend.
Try one of the many new drinks like the Red Bull Dragonberry Energizer, also available with Red Bull Zero, now at McDonald's.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Plus, terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randall. Dive into the live courtroom drama as we bring you unfiltered audio from one of the most riveting trials of the year. Accused of multiple marital murders, Randall's fate unfolds before us. Join us as we navigate the testimonies, the tension, and the truth behind the headlines. This is Dark Vows.
We are back on the record with C250966, State of Nevada versus Thomas Randolph. May the record play Mr. Randolph is present with his attorney, Deputy District Attorney, on behalf of the state. Do both parties stipulate to the presence of our jury?
Yes, Your Honor.
We do.
Does the defense have any further witnesses they intend to call?
We do not have any further witnesses. However, prior to arresting, we would move for admission by stipulation of defense proposed X and Y.
X and Y? Any objection?
No, it's by stipulation, Your Honor.
Okay, well, those will be stipulated to, okay?
And it is time the defense would rest.
Okay,
Your Honor, there was one other stipulation, and that Mr. Randolph, at the time of this incident, had a residence in Clearfield, Utah, and the state was stipulated to that.
That's correct. We'll stipulate
that. Okay, that is a fact that has been stipulated to by the parties, and at this point, the defense would rest.
Yes,
Your Honor. Do you have any rebuttal witnesses?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the presentation of evidence in this case. So we have now reached the portion where I will now read you the instructions in the law that apply to this case. You have a packet that was left in your chair that's entitled Jury Instructions to the Jury. Those are the ones that I'm going to read to you. Feel free to follow along as I read those. Instruction number one. It is now my duty as judge to instruct you in the law that applies to this case. It is your duty as jurors to follow these instructions and to apply the rules of law to the facts as you find them from the evidence. You must not be concerned with the wisdom of any rule of law stated in these instructions. Regardless of any opinion you may have as to what the law ought to be, it would be a violation of your oath to base a verdict about any other view of the law than that given in the instructions of this court. Instruction number two. If in these instructions any rule, direction, or idea is repeated or stated in different ways, no emphasis thereon is intended by me, and none may be inferred by you. For that reason, you are not to single out any certain sentence or any individual point or instruction and ignore the others, but you are to consider all the instructions as a whole and regard each in the light of all the others. The order in which the instructions are given has no significance as to their relative importance. Instruction number three. An amended indictment is but a formal method of accusing a person of a crime and is not of itself any evidence of his guilt. In this case, it is charged in an amended indictment that on or about May 8th of 2008, defendant committed the offenses of conspiracy to commit murder and murder with use of a deadly weapon, adding within the county of Clark, state of Nevada, as follows. Count one, conspiracy to commit murder. Did then and now meet with Michael James Miller and between themselves and each of them with the other willfully and unlawfully conspire and agree to commit the crime of murder. And in furtherance of said conspiracy, defendant and Michael James Miller did commit the acts as set forth in count two, said act being incorporated by this reference as though fully set forth herein. Count two, murder with use of a deadly weapon. Did then and there willfully, unlawfully, clumsy, and without lawful authority and with malice aforethought, kill Sharon Cause Randolph, a human being, in the following manner, to wit, by shooting at and into the head of Sharon Cause Randolph with a firearm. The actions of the defendant Thomas Randolph and his accomplice Michael James Miller, resulting in the death of the said Sharon Cause Randolph, said killing having been one, willful, deliberate, and premeditated, and or two, committed by defendant and or his accomplice lying in wait to commit the killing, and or three, committed during the perpetration or attempted perpetration of a robbery, said defendant being responsible under one or more of the following principles of criminal liability, to wit, one, by directly committing the act, and or two, by defendant conspiring with Michael James Miller with the specific intent that a killing occur, whereby each is vicariously liable for the foreseeable acts of the other made in furtherance of the conspiracy, and or three, by the defendant and Michael James Miller aiding and abetting each other with the specific intent that a killing occur, by counseling, encouraging, commanding, or procuring the other to commit the offense, by defendant planning the killing of Sharon Cause Randolph with accomplice Michael James Miller, the defendant thereafter being present outside the home when Sharon Cause Randolph entered the home she shared with the defendant's accomplice Michael James Miller acting in the role of a burglar, shot Sharon Cause Randolph in the head pursuant to the agreement and plan of the defendant and his accomplice Michael James Miller. Count three, murder with use of a deadly weapon. Did then and there willfully, flawlessly, and without authority of law, and with premeditation and deliberation, and with malice aforethought, kill Michael James Miller, a human being, by defendant shooting the victim in the head and body with a deadly weapon, to wit, a firearm. It is the duty of the jury to apply the rules of law contained in these instructions to the facts of the case and determine whether or not the defendant is guilty of one or more of the offenses charged. Each charge and the evidence pertaining to it should be considered separately. The fact that you may find a defendant guilty or not guilty as to one of the offenses charged should not control your verdict as to any other defendant or offense charged. Instruction number four. A conspiracy is an agreement between two or more persons for an unlawful purpose. To be guilty of conspiracy, a defendant must intend to commit or to aid in the commission of the specific crime agreed to. The crime is the agreement to do something unlawful. It does not matter whether it was successful or not. A person who knowingly does any act to further the object of a conspiracy or otherwise participates therein is criminally liable as a conspirator. However, mere knowledge or approval of or acquiescence in the object and purpose of a conspiracy without an agreement to cooperate in achieving such object or purpose does not make one a party to a conspiracy. Conspiracy is seldom susceptible of direct proof and is usually established by inference from the conduct of the parties. In particular, conspiracy may be supported by a coordinated series of facts in furtherance of the underlying offense sufficient to infer the existence of an agreement. A conspiracy to commit a crime does not end upon the completion of the crime. The conspiracy continues until the co-conspirators have successfully gotten away and concealed the crime. Instruction number five. It is not necessary to prove a conspiracy to show a meeting of the alleged conspirators or the making of an express or formal agreement. The formation and existence of a conspiracy may be inferred from all the circumstances tending to show the common intent and may be proved in the same way as any other fact may be proved, either by direct testimony of the fact or by circumstantial evidence or by both direct and circumstantial evidence. Instruction number six. Each member of a criminal conspiracy is liable for each act and bound by each declaration of every other member of the conspiracy if the act or the declaration is in furtherance of the object of the conspiracy. The act of one co-conspirator pursuant to or in furtherance of the common design of the conspiracy is the act of all conspirators. Every conspirator is legally responsible for a specific intent crime of a co-conspirator so long as the specific intent crime was intended by the defendant. A conspirator is also legally responsible for a general intent crime that follows as one of the reasonably foreseeable consequences of the object of the conspiracy, even if it is not intended as part of the original plan, and even if he was not present at the time of the commission of such act. Instruction number seven. Evidence that a person was in the company or associated with one or more other persons alleged or proven to have been members of a conspiracy is not, in itself, sufficient to prove that such person was a member of an alleged conspiracy. However, you are instructed that presence, companionship, and conduct before, during, and after the offenses are circumstances from which one's participation in the criminal intent may be inferred. Instruction number eight. Where two or more persons are accused of committing a crime together, their guilt may be established without proof that each personally did every act constituting the offense charged. All persons concerned in the commission of a crime who either directly or actively commit the act constituting the offense or who knowingly and with criminal intent aid and abet its commission, or whether present or not, who advise and encourage its commission with the intent that the crime be committed, are regarded by the law as principals in the crime thus committed and are equally guilty thereof. A person aids and abets the commission of a crime if he knowingly and with criminal intent aids, promotes, encourages, or instigates by act or advice or by act and advice the commission of such crime with the intention that the crime be committed. The state is not required to prove precisely which defendant actually committed the crime and which defendant aided and abetted. Instruction number 9. Robbery is the unlawful taking of personal property from another or in his presence against his will by means of force or violence or fear of injury, immediate or future, to his person or property, or the person or property of a member of his family or of anyone in his company at the time of the robbery. Such force or fear must be used to obtain or retain possession of the property, to prevent or overcome resistance to the taking of the property, or to facilitate escape with the property. In any case, the degree of force is immaterial if it's used to compel acquiescence to the taking of or escaping with the property. Such taking constitutes robbery whenever it appears that although the taking was fully completed without the knowledge of the person from whom taken, such knowledge was prevented by the use of force or fear. The value of property or money taken is not an element at the time of robbery, and it is only necessary if the state prove the taking of some property or money. Instruction number 10. Robbery may be spread over considerable and varying periods of time. All matters immediately prior to and having direct causal connection with the robbery are deemed so closely connected with it as to be part of the occurrence. Thus, although acts of violence and intimidation preceded the actual taking of the property and may have been primarily intended for that for another purpose, it is enough to support the charge of robbery when a person takes the property by taking advantage of the terrifying situation he created. Instruction number 11. Murder in the first degree is a specific offense crime. Defendant cannot be held liable under conspiracy and or aiding and abetting theory for first degree murder for acts committed by a co-conspirator, unless the defendant also had a premeditated and deliberate specific intent to kill and or the intent to commit robbery under the felony murder theory. Murder in the second degree and robbery are general intent crimes. As such, defendant may be held liable under conspiracy theory and or aiding and abetting for murder of the second degree and robbery for acts committed by a co-conspirator if the killing or taking the property by force is a one of the reasonably foreseeable consequences of the object of the conspiracy. Instruction number 12. Where several parties join together in a common scheme to commit an unlawful act, each is criminally responsible for the reasonably foreseeable general intent crimes committed furtherance of the common design. In contemplation of law as it relates to general intent crimes, the act of one is the act of all. Robbery and battery are general intent crimes. Second-degree murder can be a general intent crime. Additionally, a co-conspirator is guilty of the specific intent offenses which he specifically intended to be committed. First-degree murder is a specific intent crime unless the felony murder rule applies. Instruction number 13. In this case, the defendant is accused of an amended indictment alleging an open charge of murder. This charge may include murder of the first degree or murder of the second degree. The jury must decide if the defendant is guilty of any offense, and if so, of which offense. Instruction number 14. Murder is the unlawful killing of a human being with malice aforethought, either express or implied. The unlawful killing may be affected by any of the various means by which death may be occasioned. Instruction number 15. Malice aforethought means the intentional doing of the wrongful act without legal cause or excuse or what the law considers adequate provocation. The condition of mind described as malice aforethought may arise from anger, hatred, revenge, or particular ill will, spite, or grudge toward the person killed. It may also arise from any unjustifiable or unlawful motive or purpose to injure another, proceeding from a hard, fatal event on mischief or with reckless disregard of consequences and social duty. Malice aforethought does not imply deliberation or the lapse of any considerable period of time between the malicious intention to injure another and the actual execution of the intent, but denotes an unlawful purpose and design as opposed to accident or mischance. Instruction number 16. Express malice is the deliberate intention unlawfully to take away the life of a human being, which is manifested by external circumstances capable of proof. Malice may be implied when no considerable provocation appears or when all the circumstances of killing show an abandoned and malignant heart. Instruction number 17. Murder of the first degree is murder which is perpetuated by means of any kind of willful, deliberate, and premeditated killing. All three elements, willfulness, deliberation, and premeditation, must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt before an accused can be convicted of first degree murder. Willfulness is the intent to kill. There need be no appreciable space of time between formation of intent to kill and the act of killing. Deliberation is the process of determining upon a course of action to kill as a result of thought, including weighing the reasons for and against the action and considering the consequences of the actions. A deliberate determination may be arrived at in a short period of time, but in all cases, determination must not be formed in passion, or if formed in passion, it must be carried out after there has been time for the passion to subside and deliberation to occur. A mere unconsidered and rash impulse is not deliberate, even though it includes the intent to kill. Premeditation is a design, a determination to kill, distinctly formed in the mind by the time of the killing. Premeditation need not be for a day, an hour, or even a minute. It may be as instantaneous as successive thoughts of the mind. For if the jury believes from the evidence that the act constituting the killing has been preceded by and has been the result of premeditation, no matter how rapidly the act follows the premeditation, it is premeditated. Instruction number 18, the law does not undertake to measure in units of time the length of period during which the thought must be pondered before it can ripen into an intent to kill, which is truly deliberate and premeditated. The time will vary within different individuals and under varying circumstances. The true test is not the duration of time, but rather the extent of the reflection. A cold, calculated judgment and decision may be arrived at in a short period of time, but a mere unconsidered and rash impulse, even though it includes an intent to kill, is not deliberation and premeditation, as will fix an unlawful killing as murder of the first degree. Instruction number 19. There are certain kinds of murder in the first degree which carry with them conclusive evidence of malice and forethought. One of these classes of first-degree murder is a killing committed in the perpetration or attempted perpetration of a robbery. Therefore, a killing which is committed in the perpetration of a robbery is deemed to be murder of the first degree, whether the killing was intentional, unintentional, or accidental. This is called the felony murder rule. The intent to perpetrate or attempt to perpetrate a robbery must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. In order for the felony murder rule to apply under the robbery theory, the intent to take property must be formed prior to the act constituting the killing. Instruction number 20. Although your verdict must be unanimous as to the charge, you do not have to agree on the theory of guilt or liability. Therefore, even if you cannot agree on whether the facts establish the defendant is guilty of premeditated deliberate murder or felony murder, or is liable as a principal, aider, and abettor, or co-conspirator, so long as you all agree that the evidence establishes the defendant's guilt of murder in the first degree, your verdict shall be murder of the first degree. Instruction number 21. You are instructed that if you find the state has established that the defendant has committed first-degree murder, you shall select first-degree murder as your verdict. The crime of first-degree murder includes the crime of second-degree murder. You may find the defendant guilty of second-degree murder if, one, you have not found beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant is guilty of murder of the first degree, and two, all 12 of you are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant is guilty of the crime of second-degree murder. If you are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty of the crime, that the crime of murder has been committed by the defendant, but you have a reasonable doubt whether such murder was of the first or of the second degree, you must give the defendant the benefit of the doubt and return a verdict of murder of the second degree. Instruction number 22. All murder which is not murder of the first degree is murder of the second degree. Murder of the second degree is murder with malice aforethought, but without the admixture of premeditation and deliberation. Instruction number 23. You are instructed, if you find the defendant is guilty of first or second degree murder, you must also determine whether or not a deadly weapon was used in the commission of this crime. If you find beyond a reasonable doubt that a deadly weapon was used in the commission of such an offense, then you shall return the appropriate guilty verdict reflecting the use of a deadly weapon. If, however, you find that a deadly weapon was not used in the commission of such an offense, but you find that it was committed, then you shall return the appropriate guilty verdict reflecting that a deadly weapon was not used. Instruction number 24. Deadly weapon means any instrument which, if used in the ordinary manner contemplated by its design and construction, will or is likely to cause substantial bodily harm or death, or any weapon, device, instrument, material, or substance which, under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing substantial bodily harm or death. A firearm is a deadly weapon. Instruction number 25. If more than one person commits a crime and one of them uses a deadly weapon in the commission of that crime, each may be convicted of using the deadly weapon even though he did not personally himself or herself use the weapon. An unarmed offender uses a deadly weapon when the unarmed offender is liable for the offense, another person liable for the offense is armed with and uses a deadly weapon in the commission of the offense, and the unarmed offender had knowledge of the use of the deadly weapon. Instruction number 26. Justifiable homicide is not unlawful. Justifiable homicide includes the killing of a human being in necessary self-defense, or in the defense of an occupied habitation, or of a person against who one who manifestly intends or endeavors to commit a crime of violence. Any person or persons who manifestly intend and endeavor in a violent, riotous, tumultuous, and surreptitious manner to enter the occupied habitation of another for the purpose of assaulting or offering personal violence to any person dwelling or being therein. A person is not required to retreat before using deadly force if the person, A, is not the original aggressor, B, has a right to be present at the location where deadly force is used, and C, is not actively engaged in conduct in furtherance of criminal activity at the time deadly force is used. Instruction number 27. The killing of another person in self-defense or in defense of another is justified and not unlawful when the person who does the killing actually and reasonably believes that there is imminent danger that the assailant will either kill him or cause him great bodily injury, and that is absolutely necessary under the circumstances for him to use in self-defense force or means that might cause the death of another person, of the other person, for the purpose of avoiding death or great bodily injury to himself. Instruction number 28, a bare fear of death or great bodily injury is not sufficient to justify killing. To justify taking the life of another in self-defense, the circumstances must be sufficient to excite the fears of a reasonable person placed in a similar situation. The person killing must act under the influence of those fears alone and not in revenge. Instruction number 29, an honest but unreasonable belief in the necessity for self-defense does not negate malice and does not reduce the offense from murder to manslaughter. Instruction number 30, the right of self-defense is not generally available to the original aggressor. That is, the person who has sought a quarrel with and is designed to force a deadly issue and thus through his fraud, contrivance, or fault to create a real or apparent necessity for making a felonious assault. The original aggressor is only entitled to exercise self-defense if he makes a good faith endeavor to decline any further struggle before the mortal blow was given. However, where a person without voluntary seeking, provoking, inviting, or willingly engaging in a difficulty of his own free will is attacked by an assailant, he has the right to stand his ground and need not retreat when faced with the threat of deadly force. Instruction number 31. Actual danger is not necessary to justify killing in self-defense. A person has a right to defend from apparent danger to the same extent as he would from actual danger. The person killing is justified if, one, he is confronted by the appearance of imminent danger, which arouses in his mind an honest belief and fear that he is about to be killed or suffer great bodily injury, and two, he acts solely upon these appearances and his fear and actual beliefs, and three, a reasonable person in a similar situation will believe himself to be in life danger. Instruction number 32, the killing is justified even if it develops afterward that the person killing was mistaken about the extent of the danger. Instruction number 33, if evidence of self-defense is present, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in self-defense. If you find that the state has failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in self-defense, you must find the defendant not guilty. Instruction 34, if a person kills another in self-defense, it must appear that the danger was so urgent and pressing that in order to save his own life or to prevent his receiving great bodily harm, the killing of the other was absolutely necessary and the person killed was the assailant, or that the slayer had really and in good faith endeavored to decline any further struggle before the mortal blow was given. Instruction number 35, it is a constitutional right of a defendant in a criminal trial that he may not be compelled to testify. Thus, the decision as to whether he should testify is left to the defendant on the advice and counsel of his attorney. You must not draw any inference of guilt from the fact that he does not testify, nor should this fact be discussed by you or enter into your deliberations in any way. Instruction number 36. Statements of the defendant not made in court have been admitted into evidence. Before the jury may take such statement into consideration, it must first decide whether or not it was given voluntarily. If the jury decides the statement was made voluntarily, it may use the statements in deliberations. If the jury decides the statement was not made voluntarily, the jury must disregard it. The state has the burden of proving the voluntariness of a statement by a preponderance of the evidence. This burden of proof should lead the trier of fact to find that the existence of the contested fact is more probable than its non-existence. The court has redacted portions of the defendant's statements that are not relevant to this proceeding. You are not to speculate about what was redacted or consider the fact that the statement was redacted in your deliberation. Instruction number 37. You have heard testimony regarding events described by Sharon Randolph to her friends. Such evidence was introduced as evidence of Sharon Randolph's state of mind. You may consider the evidence to the extent you think it is relevant to Sharon Randolph's state of mind. You may not consider this evidence as evidence of events that occurred or any other purpose. This applies to witnesses 1, Colleen Byer, 2, Michael Byer, 3, Deidre Marley, 4, Alice Wolfe, 5, Antoinette Beam, and 6, Victoria Kamenica. Instruction number 38. To constitute the crime charge, there must exist a union or joint operation of an act forbidden by law and an intent to do the act. The intent with which an act is done is shown by the facts and circumstances surrounding the case. Do not confuse intent with motive. Motive is what prompts a person to act. Intent refers only to the state of mind with which an act is done. Motive is not an element of the crime charge, and the state is not required to prove a motive on the part of the defendant in order to convict. However, you may consider evidence of motive or lack of motive as a circumstance in the case. Instruction number 39. The defendant is presumed innocent until the contrary is proved. This presumption places upon the state the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt every material element of the crime charge that the defendant is the person who committed the offense. A reasonable doubt is one based on reason. It is not mere possible doubt, but is such a doubt as would govern or control a person in the more weighty affairs of life. If the minds of the jurors, after the entire comparison and consideration of all the evidence, are in such a condition that they can say they feel an abiding conviction of the truth of the charge, there is not a reasonable doubt. Doubt to the reasonable must be actual, not mere possibility or speculation. If you have a reasonable doubt as to the guilt of the defendant, he is entitled to a verdict of not guilty. Instruction number 4. You are here to determine the guilt or innocence of the defendant from the evidence in the case. You are not called upon to return a verdict as to the guilt or innocence of any other person. So if the evidence in the case convinces you beyond a reasonable doubt of the guilt of the defendant, you should so find, even though you may believe one or more persons are also guilty. Instruction number 41. The evidence which you are considering in this case consists of the testimony, the witnesses, the exhibits, and any facts admitted or agreed to by counsel. There are two types of evidence, direct and circumstantial. Direct evidence is the testimony of a person who claims to have personal knowledge of the commission of the crime which has been charged, such as an eyewitness. Circumstantial evidence is the proof of a chain of facts and circumstances which tend to show whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty. The law makes no distinction between the weight to be given either direct or circumstantial evidence. Therefore, all the evidence in the case, including circumstantial evidence, should be considered by you in arriving at your verdict. Statements, arguments, and opinions of counsel are not evidence in the case. However, if the attorney stipulates to the existence of a fact, you must accept the stipulation as evidence and regard that fact as proof. You must not speculate to be true any insinuation suggested by a question asked a witness. A question is not evidence and may be considered only if it supplies meaning to the answer. You must disregard any evidence to which an objection was sustained by the court or any evidence ordered distributed by the court. Anything you may have seen or heard outside the courtroom is not evidence and must also be disregarded. Instruction number 42. Whenever there is slight evidence that a conspiracy existed and that the defendant was one of the members of the conspiracy, then the statements and the acts by any person, likewise a member, may be considered by the jury as evidence in the case as to the defendant found to have been a member, even though the statements and acts may have occurred in the absence and without the knowledge of the defendant. Provided such statements and acts were knowingly made and done during the continuance of such a conspiracy and in furtherance of service of the conspiracy. Instruction number 43. The credibility or believability of a witness should be determined by his manner upon the stand, his relationship to the parties, his fears, motives, interests, or feelings, his opportunity to observe the manner in which he testified, the reasonableness of his statements, and the strength or weakness of his recollections. If you believe that a witness has lied about a material fact in the case, you may disregard the entire testimony of that witness or any other portion of the testimony which is not proved by other evidence. Instruction number 44. The fact that a witness has been convicted of a felony, if such be a fact, may be considered by you only for the purpose of determining the credibility of that witness. The fact of such a conviction does not necessarily destroy or impair the witness's credibility. It is one of the circumstances that you may take into consideration in weighing the testimony of such a witness. Instruction number 45. The witness who has special knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education in a particular science, profession, or occupation is an expert witness. An expert witness may give his opinion as to any matter in which he is skilled. You should consider such expert opinion and weigh the reasons that have been given for it. You are not bound, however, by such an opinion. Give it the weight to which you deem it entitled, whether that be great or slight, and you may reject it if, in your judgment, the reasons given for it are unsound. Instruction number 46. Although you are to consider only the evidence in this case and reaching a verdict, you must bring to the consideration of evidence your everyday common sense and judgment as reasonable men and women. Thus, you're not limited solely to what you see and hear as the witnesses testify. You may draw reasonable inferences from the evidence you feel are justified in the light of common experience. Keep in mind that such inferences should not be based on speculation or guess. A verdict may never be influenced by sympathy, prejudice, or public opinion. Your decision should be the product of sincere judgment and sound discretion in accordance with these rules of law. Instruction number 47. In arriving at a verdict in this case as to whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty, the subject of penalty or punishment is not to be discussed or considered by you and should in no way influence your verdict. That is a matter left to the discretion of the court. Instruction number 48. During the course of this trial and your deliberations, you are not to, one, communicate with anyone in any way regarding this case or its merits, either by phone, text, internet, or other means. Two, read, watch, listen to news or media accounts or commentary about the case. Three, do any research such as consulting dictionaries using the internet or using reference materials. Or four, make any investigation, test the theory of the case, recreate the aspect of the case, or in any other way investigate or learn about the case on your own. Instruction number 49. If during your deliberation you should desire to be further informed on any point of law or hear again portions of testimony, you must reduce your request to writing signed by the foreperson. The officer will then return you to court where the information sought will be given to you in the presence of and after notice to the district attorney, the defendant, and his counsel. Playbacks of testimony are time-consuming and are not encouraged unless you deem it a necessity. Should you require a playback, you must carefully describe the testimony to be played back so that the court recorder can arrange your notes. Remember, the court is not at liberty to supplement the evidence. Instruction number 50. When you retire to consider your verdict, you must select one of your number to act as a foreperson who will preside over your deliberation and will be your spokesperson here in court. During your deliberation, you will have all the exhibits which are admitted in evidence, those written instructions and forms of verdict which have been prepared for your convenience. Your verdict must be unanimous. As soon as you have agreed upon a verdict, have it signed and dated by your foreperson and then return with it to this room. Instruction number 51. Now you will listen to the arguments of counsel who will endeavor to aid you to reach a proper verdict by refreshing in your mind the evidence and by showing the application thereof to the law. But whatever counsel may say, you will bear in mind that it is your duty to be governed in your deliberation by the evidence as you understand it and remember it to be and by the law as given to you in these instructions, with the sole fixed and steadfast purpose of doing equal and exact justice between the defendant and the state of Nevada. Yeah. State, are you prepared to give a closing argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is now the portion of trial where the closing arguments will be begun. Since the state has the burden of proof, they will be allowed to open and close the arguments.
Thank you. Can I proceed?
Yes, whenever you're ready.
Okay. So, good afternoon. On May 8th of 2008, there were three people in a house on Rancho Santa Fe Drive. That included Sharon Randolph, it included the defendant Thomas Randolph, and it included Michael Miller. At the end of that evening, two individuals from that residence were shot with guns inside the residence, and the only injury that Mr. Randolph reported was an injury to his mouth. So he basically left this exchange with barely a scratch on it. Now, Mr. Randolph offered sort of a time-tested version of events. I am a homeowner. There was an intruder who came in. I wasn't able to save my wife, but thankfully I was able to save myself. And the police could have taken one look at Mr. Randolph and one look at Mr. Miller and just accepted that version of events and sort of moved on and not really done a lot of investigation. They could have accepted that narrative. But they had to wonder, like, does the evidence make sense? Is Thomas Randolph alive because he was able to physically outmatch a younger, healthier man, or because he betrayed and deceived him after the two conspired to kill Sharon Randolph? Now, in writing and in movies, there's a writing device called an unreliable narrator. An unreliable narrator is an untrustworthy storyteller, most often used in narratives with a first-person point of view. And we see this in books and sometimes in movies, but we also see it a lot more in 2020 and onward as cell phones became more prevalent, right? Someone would say, hey, that guy was mean to me in a park, and then someone would have cell phone evidence sort of disputing that. Or someone may report, hey, that guy came at me, and that's why I shot that person. But then there's someone on the street with a cell phone, and they're able to reveal the person to be an unreliable narrator. Now, in this case, obviously in that house in 2008, there was not cell phone video that showed the exchange of what happened that night. But you do have physical evidence, and you do have statements, and you have ballistic evidence that will show you that Thomas Randolph is an unreliable narrator. And he kind of characterizes himself as that. In that third interview with detectives on June the 3rd of 2008, he describes himself as reasonably honest. That's not 100% honest. That's not absolutely honest. His words are reasonably honest. The one thing our narrator, Thomas Randolph, sticks to consistently is that his shooting of Michael Miller occurred in the hallway of the residence in the area leading into the garage.
So it was clearing space from him.
Clearing space from him and just a few minutes before I shot him. I mean, I started shooting him just as soon as I got a little bit of room.
Did you fire again in this hallway?
Yeah, I believe so. Like I said, I fired a lot, and then he came out and turned around again.
And now, is he in the garage now?
He's right at the doorway there. I think he was trying to open the garage door. As we got up in here, he kind of rushed up on me a little bit, and that's when I just pushed him, boom, boom, boom! And he started going out toward the shed. I don't know how many times I shot him, but I just kept right on going. boom, boom, boom. And he just lay in there. Just lay in there, no.
Where was he in relation to you when you fired the first time?
Maybe right there.
So he's, now is he going?
No, he's turned toward me still. He's still. Nope, he's still trying to dig. He's still digging out. He's just like this, just digging out. I'm kind of coming. I'm just coming at him. I'm going to shoot him. I mean, there's no. He seen me, then he just turned around, just kind of. No, he wasn't running. He was backing the whole time. Just keep, you know, keeping an eye on him. He's, yeah, kind of. He's keeping an eye on me. He's keeping an eye on me, see where I'm going.
So now he's gotten over here, and he's still squared off against you?
Pretty close, I think. I just started shooting. But he's more maybe kind of like that a little bit. Seems like it was like that, but it was just like, it was close. It was pretty close. Might have been a little further back. Yeah. Okay, I'm coming at about the same time, too, and about right here, we hit. And he's coming... He's coming down just like this.
He's there. He's off.
Yeah, kind of.
Then what happened? Just
kind of like that. I was already shooting.
Okay. So you fired the first time. You stepped. Go ahead and repeat this movie.
Wherever we're doing something here. And I don't know if I hit him. I don't know if that's when he got his gun out. If he just said, fuck it, I'm running. I don't know what the deal was. It seems like I shot him again, maybe like about right here. And then he started turning like this toward the door. And I shot. I may have emptied the gun. I don't know.
You're listening to Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randolph. There's more raw courtroom drama ahead as we bring you unfiltered audio from trial. Join us as we navigate the testimonies, the tension, and the truth behind the headlines. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a minute. More Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randolph, next.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.